Thank you for listening to PolitiTalk with Lane Palmer. Today on my podcast, I have a guest who has been here before, Adam. So Adam, we recorded, I think, our episode maybe a little under a year ago. I think it may have been later on in the spring, early summer-ish. And the world was kind of a much different place. I mean, we had a different president at that time. And I have to say, I stand corrected in terms of who I thought was going to win this election. I mean, I had assumed that Donald Trump was going to get another term, and that did not happen. I haven't spoken to you since the election. Any kind of just quick thoughts or just anything about how it kind of turned out? Did you see this coming as it got closer? Was it kind of a shock to you?
Yeah, so I, like you, I was proven wrong. If I recall correctly, I think I was also suspecting, perhaps cautiously, but suspecting nonetheless that Trump would win re-election. I think as the world, as you mentioned, the world has shifted entirely in the year or so since I was last on the podcast here. I think that shift in sort of the external circumstances is what changed the day. I genuinely believe that in a world without the coronavirus, I think you probably have President Donald Trump still sitting in the Oval Office right now. I think just those very different challenges we're facing are ones that the public did not at large react favorably to his response. And in the end of the day, they wanted somebody that they felt was going to provide what they sensed was a more stable leadership, if you will.
Do you think that Trump's response in terms of vaccine production and anything like that would have been different from what we're seeing now from the Biden party?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say, obviously, what someone who wasn't in power would have done had they had the opportunity. Just, again, with such an unprecedented set of circumstances that we've encountered. I will say the work that the Trump administration did to get, you know, all the necessary research and trials for a vaccine and have it ready for distribution within 9 or 10 months. I mean, it was called Operation Warp Speed for a reason. And I think that for any criticism that you could lob about how the Trump administration handled the pandemic, I think one thing that does absolutely stand out is their very rapid success in getting a vaccine up and ready for distribution. And we're now seeing that's already being distributed to states across the country, and people are getting their immunizations. And hopefully that's being to provide the first light at the end of the tunnel for the pandemic here.
Yeah, definitely. What is your reaction to kind of the fallout of the election? I mean, obviously, it took a while for the results to be announced. A lot of people were getting very anxious. Obviously, the Trump team did everything within their legal rights to push back a little bit on some states' electors. What was your results? What was your reaction to those results and what the Trump team was doing after the election?
Yeah, so this is, we could probably spend an entire hour or two just on this topic, but I'll try and offer a few quick thoughts here. So first, I know there are plenty of people out there who are still saying, you know, that this wasn't a fair election, it was rigged, whatever. Joe Biden is president of the United States, duly elected, sworn in. That's the way it is. Sorry if you don't like it. I'll say that up front here. That being said, it's interesting. A lot of what the Trump team was pushing back on in terms of, you know, voter fraud or illegal voters, these are tropes that we've heard, you know, trotted out by the Trump team before. We heard that in 2016 when he lost the popular vote, and I believe we heard some of it even in the 2018 midterms. Where I think they had probably the strongest argument is this idea that in states like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Georgia, there is some question as to whether or not those states followed their own prescribed election laws as laid out in their, you know, state statutes or their constitutions or whatever. And again, a lot of states did have to adjust sort of on the fly to a bizarre and unprecedented set of circumstances, namely the pandemic. You know, in Ohio, we had a lot of confusion with the March primary, which then became the April primary, and some people were trying to make the June primary, and obviously there's a need to adjust to that. But what I think the Trump administration, had they really wanted to pursue sort of a narrow focused strategy of really hammer the points we think we're strongest on, I think probably their biggest issue is the question still surrounding signature verification on mail-in ballots and registration and things like that, and just confirming that all of the ballots that came in by mail were from people voting in a place they were eligible to vote in, not from out of state, not from a different county, what have you. Because, you know, you think about not just the presidential election, but all these things up and down the ballot, county commissioners, local school board, what have you. And in a mail-in ballot situation, especially in some states where ballots were being mailed unsolicited, if I'm not mistaken, to individuals, it's very easy to find yourself in a situation where a ballot ends up at an address where that person no longer lives, or it's forwarded to them and now they have a ballot for a place they used to live, and just all sorts of genuine legitimate questions that were raised. And I think the Trump campaign's mistake was in casting too wide of a net in their accusations. Having a little more narrow focus on where they can point to specific instances of, again, signature verification, identity verification, you know, ballots being postmarked too late or what have you, would have been the smarter route to go to try and have sort of a more targeted response to what they felt were inconsistencies.
Yeah, definitely. And to even think about it now, as we're talking, we haven't spoken since the insurrection at the Capitol. I mean, we already know the outcome now, but what were your initial thoughts kind of seeing those videos on the news as the stories were pouring in?
And it was, I'll say this, it's one of those uniquely heartbreaking scenes that you do not see often and that you hope you'll never see again. You know, the image of a mob, some of them armed, breaking into the United States Capitol, or forcing their way in, rather, you know, breaking their way up the Senate floor and forcing elected officials to flee. It made me sick to my stomach to see it unfolding. It was... It's the sort of images that I think former President George W. Bush said it very well in his statement. Those are the kinds of images that you see in a banana republic and not a democratic republic. Yeah. So it was very troubling to see that unfolding, and certainly a difficult day for America, and a difficult thing to watch kind of happening in a country where that's not, with the exception perhaps of, you know, the Civil War, even in the 1960s, there was a lot of political upheaval, but it never got to the point where you had protesters and rioters breaking into, you know, the room where it happened, so to speak, and trying to actually drive those people from their seats and stop an electoral process from happening. Discouraging, disheartening, and frightening, quite frankly.
Yeah. Obviously, they voted to impeach and not convict. Do you believe that the Republicans made the right decision in doing that?
So I believe that, obviously, words have power. And the president, I think you can make an argument that President Trump, through his overarching rhetoric of the last 4 or 5 years, you know, he has a very fiery, almost inflammatory style. You know, his entire MO seems to be get people riled up, get people passionate. And there's an element of that in all political speeches, but Trump's sort of uniquely fiery brand of populism is something that we don't typically see from a mainstream politician, let alone a president of the United States. For better or worse, some can argue that, you know, the straight talk and shoot from the hip type is exactly what's needed to undo Washington gridlock, and some will argue that it's something that should never be allowed near the most powerful office in the world. Mm-hmm. All that to say, I think as much as you can say, yes, the president's actions contributed to an attitude that boiled over, I think I personally, if I were a Republican senator or even a Democratic senator, looking at the evidence before me and looking at the situation as it was presented, I think I would stop short of saying that that mob breaking into the Capitol, that attempted insurrection, if we are to call it that, was a direct result of things that Donald Trump said. Because if you watch when he was giving the speech that was cited as, you know, saying, go to the Capitol, go and fight like hell, all these different things, he, at the end, he said, and go and do it peacefully and patriotically. And if I recall correctly, looking at the timeline, the armed protesters had already begun breaking into the Capitol before he began that speech. He was delivering the speech as people were breaking into the Capitol down the road.
So, right.
So all that to say, you know, it's not unfair to say that he contributed to the situation, but I do think it's a bridge too far to say that incident happened because of things Donald Trump said and specific words that he was using.
Mm. Here's what I kind of thought the situation, how it was going to go down, because this is the main reason why I wanted to bring you on, was it seems as now there is this faction between your Meghan McCain, Cindy McCain's of the Republican Party, Liz Cheney's, and the people in the party like your Ted Cruz's that support Trump. And it seems like they're at this kind of gridlock in terms of where they want the party to go. I mean, there's even talks, obviously, of Trump forming a third party. And we can get into that a little bit later. So I had assumed Mitch McConnell being the man that he is, in reports coming out of him being happy that the Democrats were starting the impeachment process, I had thought he was going to take this opportunity to convict Trump so that way he could never run for public office again. And that way the Republican Party, the conservatives, could choose who they would have being their front runner for the next presidential election. I was wrong. He ended up obviously not voting to do that, but he did obviously say that he felt that Trump's actions were terrible, and obviously Trump had written, I guess, a scathing letter to McConnell that was not too pretty. Do you see these factions forming as somebody who tends to be a little bit more conservative?
You know, I do see the factions forming to a certain extent. And factions form within political parties all the time. You could argue that, you know, they're growing out of factions that were forming long before Donald Trump was even a serious consideration for the presidency. You know, the conservative portion of the Republican Party springing out largely of the Tea Party movement of about 10 years ago, and this more sort of moderate, you know, Mitt Romney, John McCain style of classic Republican that's a holdover from an earlier era. So you could see the seeds of those factions forming, and you can see the same thing on the Democratic side of the aisle as well, with some of the more progressive Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders types leading that sort of that push to the left, and your more centrist candidates, like I would argue even Joe Biden. Joe Biden has gotten more progressive over time, but I would argue at the end of the day, if you're going to divide the camps, so to speak, into a Bernie Sanders camp and a Joe Biden camp, I think it's fair to say there are people in the Joe Biden camp who are not necessarily in the Bernie Sanders camp. And so with this specifically, though, the impeachment issue of having the anti-Trump, in a new sense of the word, there's always been an anti-Trump Republican, but now this is sort of an anti-Trump faction that wants to see Donald Trump eliminated entirely from the party because they believe it embodies everything that they have been getting wrong within their own party. as opposed to, as you mentioned, types like Ted Cruz or Josh Hawley or these more conservative Republicans who are going to go out and argue that Donald Trump was the breath of fresh air that the Republican Party needed, you know, to kind of reinvigorate themselves after a run of electoral losses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that is a very interesting point. I mean, to be fair, the Trump camp did expand a lot of reach in terms of the people of color who voted for him. And I mean, getting that many votes. I mean, I had assumed that he was either going to get the same amount of votes he did last time or a little bit more. I didn't anticipate him getting that much more. I mean, by all accounts, I don't think that this was as far of an election as many people would like it to be. I mean, it was very close. I mean, that's why you couldn't call it for several days after the fact. So what happens now? I mean, does the party bring back Trump for their 2024 seat, or do they put in somebody else? I mean, what if you were leading the Republican, you know, caucus, what would you do?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? So I think, going back just for a second to what you were saying about the, you know, this possibility of a third party offshoot, it's interesting because I have heard both that Trump himself wants to form a third party, which last I heard he was outright denying, saying that wasn't in his plans. Mm. On the other hand, I've heard people also saying that the anti-Trump faction that we just talked about is the one that wants to form a third party. And it's interesting, this idea of there doesn't seem to be agreement necessarily as to which faction is more dominant within the Republican Party. Are the old school John McCain, Mitt Romney Republicans the ones who really have more cards, or is it the pro-Trump crowd that is going to carry the banner forward? To answer your question about candidacies, I think a lot of it comes down to whether or not Donald Trump himself decides he wants to make another poke at this in 2024, because he was not convicted during the impeachment. He is eligible to run again as a one-term president, as is, incidentally, Jimmy Carter, should he so choose to run. you know, I think Trump right now, and he has a little bit of time to think about this, whether he believes he's going to be more influential as sort of a behind-the-scenes kind of person. He's already talked about building, you know, a conservative storehouse of PAC money to give to his sort of anointed candidates for the House and Senate in 2022.
Right.
Or if he decides that he believes he has the political strength to mount a comeback and become only the second president in history to be elected to two non-consecutive terms. It's hard to say right now, I think, where that's going to fall, because we're still seeing a lot of the dust settle from this. I will say it's not out of the realm of possibility to believe that Donald Trump could be the nominee in 2024. And I believe that if he does in fact declare, he will win, only because, much as we saw in 2016, there will still be that surprisingly strong base of people. They're not necessarily Republicans, they're not necessarily Democrats, but they latch onto the idea of Donald Trump in the sense that he represents everything a traditional politician is not. And this is the kind of person that you see across, especially middle America and in the working class, that gravitates to Bernie Sanders for very similar reasons. I think we talked about that a little bit last time I was on the podcast, that somebody who's willing to say these radically different things and kind of rattle the cages of the political establishment, if you will, for better or worse, that's the kind of person that a disenchanted voter latches onto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I mean, that is why, for as many times as Trump has, you know, said some mean things about Bernie, he's also been the one defending him during the election process too, which is kind of insane. But no, I think you're exactly right. I kind of see the party swing that way as well. I mean, it seems to me that a lot of the more conservative people, you know, who go against Trumpism, as you would call it, they either tend to not run for re-election, or they just kind of you know, fade into oblivion because they don't think that they have the ability to win the seat, especially if they're pressured by a person who is a Trump nominee or a Trump candidate. So, I mean, I think eventually, I think the entire party, we will be like a Trump party, I guess you could say. So yeah, I could definitely see that happening. Let's see, what else did I want to ask you about? Oh yes, the very unfortunate climate crisis we're having right now in terms of Texas. Oh my goodness. So the reason why I probably wanted to push it out of my head was because I'm in auto insurance claims, and we've been getting calls from Texas all week. Our phone lines have been backed up. People are not being able to get the help that they need, unfortunately, just because of how many people are disenfranchised by this. It's frustrating to me because this, of course, falls back on another topic that we'll get to eventually, that I think America is more of a reactionary country in terms of how they handle things instead of a preemptive. And they've known, I read a report today from 2011, 10 years ago, that this electric grid needed work. And they chose to not do anything for 10 years. And now we are seeing the ramifications. I guess, aside from that, what is your reaction to all of this and just how it's being handled?
Yeah, so I have not had a chance to dig into a lot of the meat and potatoes, as it were, on the Texas electric grid situation. Mm-hmm. But from what I have read, my understanding is that a lot of the problem has stemmed from the fact that Texas at some point elected to go with essentially an independent energy grid. And so when you have in other parts of the country, if there's a massive power outage in, say, Minnesota, they're able to divert some of the power from the grid in Wisconsin to help get the situation resolved. Mm-hmm. With Texas sort of on its own and having its own independent power grid, when that whole system goes down, and Texas obviously is not used to snowstorms and ice storms like this, it's very unusual for how far south they are. Mm-hmm. When they get hit with something unexpected like that, being sort of disconnected from the rest of the country's power grid makes it incredibly difficult to get things back up and running. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who lives in Texas. Shout out to Nicole. I hope that she's staying warm and safe in all this. But she's been telling me that part of the problem is they have got a significant portion of their energy grid that relies on wind power, and because it's been so cold, the windmills are frozen, the turbines aren't able to spin, and so they're not able to generate that power, which is just compounding to the problem of an independent energy grid not just not being able to pull power from other states and other regions, but now having a significant portion of what's powering your grid in a place where it literally will not be able to generate power until it warms up more.
Yeah, it's just so frustrating because at every point it seems as though that, again, they are aware of these issues beforehand, like if something like this possibly occurring. And I mean, of course, with any natural disaster, with this, with COVID, there's going to be a lot of unknown elements, right? Things you can't really plan on. But like a lot of these issues, it seems as though that they are aware of beforehand and they do have the ability to stop, but they just choose not to. Why are so many politicians in our government so resistant to being preemptive?
Well, and I'll agree with you that we are, I think, by and large, a reactionary country. I'll say this, one of the, you either got to laugh or got to cry with the pandemic, right? And something I saw very early on when, Europe was doing a relatively good job of bouncing back from horrific situations and being able to rebuild fairly quickly and get back to some semblance of normal, I saw this put as, imagine that all the countries of the world are a kindergarten class, and the teacher is explaining that you can eat the marshmallow I'm about to give you right now, or you cannot eat it, and I'll give you a second marshmallow the United States ate their first marshmallow before the teacher even finishing the instructions, and now every other country is sitting around with their second marshmallow, happy as a clam, while we're still stuck here with nothing. Mm-hmm. and so using that analogy, I think, is very apt in this idea of a reactionary versus a preemptive strategy, just as a country as a whole, and whether that comes from sort of the instant gratification that's a little inherent in modern American culture or whatever it is, I think you're absolutely right that this is a nation which by and large deals with problems after they become unavoidable rather than trying to head them off the pass. And as you mentioned, you know, you can see that with a whole host of issues. People don't begin talking about insert crisis here until it becomes a crisis. And there's, and I will say this, just to argue the other side of the coin very briefly, in all fairness, we only see the crises that occur. You know, it's difficult perhaps to gauge what proactive steps we've taken to mitigate other potential crises. But that being said, as you've alluded to, we have experienced a series, you know, there's a power crisis, there's a climate crisis, there's a a health crisis, and all of these things we're trying to battle at once here, partially because there wasn't enough groundwork laid beforehand to try and prepare, not that you could prepare for something like this, but at least be ready in case things began to function abnormally, in case there were something of concern that needed to be addressed relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with having, like a board. Let's just assign a random board to look over something, right? Like, let's have this board ask these questions. What happens if we get an ice storm down here? What happens if this happens? Like, there's, I feel like as long as there are ideas of, like, what ifs, and there are protocols in place to fix that, I feel like it would be a much better situation. But anyway, I digress. Another story taking the world by storm right now, obviously, is Cuomo in New York lying about COVID deaths in nursing homes. Love to see bipartisan, both Democrats and Republicans, launching that investigation into him. Joe Biden also stated that bipartisanship was something that was a hot topic of his that he wanted to try and implement. But unfortunately, at least from where I'm standing, it doesn't seem that is happening. The two parties are still kind of in gridlock with each other. Do you see, as the years progress, any semblance of bipartisanship happening, or is it just going to be one party versus the other until the end of time?
Well, I like to fancy myself an optimist and hope that, you know, because I read a lot of history. You and I have discussed this before, off the podcast. But we've gone through cycles like this in American history. We've gone through these very fragmented periods. Immediately after the founding, there was this bitter divide that very rapidly formed between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, boiling down essentially to the age-old problem we still face of should the federal government be more or less powerful. You had, obviously, in the 1860s, things came to a head with the Civil War, political disruption boiling over to a point that the country literally tore itself in two and divided over the deep-held differences that they had about how a government should be run and about how states should be allowed to run their governments, in addition to other things. But that was certainly a factor. In the 1960s, when you had a lot of social unrest and political upheaval, you had the civil rights movement, you had the Vietnam War protests, you had the mob violence outside the Democratic National Convention in 1968, and now currently, as we see with this very polarized world. When I say that I'm an optimist, I say that because we have seen in each of those cases, we have gotten past it for a time. The anti-federalist and federalist debate gave way to the era of good feelings in the 1820s, where there was, for really the only time in American history, one political party. Factions within that party, but only one dominant political party, the Democratic Republicans. The Civil War, for as mixed a bag as Reconstruction was, we were, as a nation, able to heal from the worst political divide that we have ever faced, and we were able to confront the causes of the Civil War. We were able to confront the issue of slavery through the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and we were able to find ways to bring the nation back together. And much the same in the 1960s, we got past that period of turmoil. We got past the Watergate era. We got past the Vietnam era. We moved into these times of enormous prosperity in the 1980s and the 1990s and the early 2000s. Not that there weren't still political divides in those times, but these sort of insurmountable challenges posed by hyper-partisanship some way or another seem to subside for a time. I'm hopeful we can do that again. It's hard to be that optimistic sometimes sitting in the middle of this and watching it as we watch a Republican Party that gets more conservative and a Democratic Party that gets more liberal, and there's less room to come together in the middle. But I'm certainly hopeful that we'll be able to find our way out of this as we have so many times before, one way or another.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest, that's really good to hear and just really reassuring. And why don't we end there? Because I'll end on a hopeful note for once. we're talking about politics. But thank you so much for coming on, Adam. I really love having you on just because you're somebody who I think I align with really well. We're both people who kind of tend to be, obviously, I lean more toward liberal stuff sometimes for certain topics, but I do try to stay independent when I can. And I think, unfortunately, people like us tend to get a little scrutinized because of our ability to counter-argument the party who they say that we align with, right? So obviously, you know, these Republicans who ended up voting to convict Trump got a lot of really nasty hate mail from their family and friends. And I hope again that we can reach a time in our country where we can have those disagreements and still see each other for the person that we are. So
absolutely.
Well, thank you again, Adam, and thank you for listening to Polititalk.